May it please the court.
Yes, you may proceed.
Counsel, I guess for the last time this session.
Don't jinx us. I'm holding you personally responsible if we have a case between now and August.
I would like to start by reading a short passage from an email from a client sent to the respondent, Robert E. Arnold III, in April of 2013. The client who wrote this email is one of the victims in this case. She died before the disciplinary hearing and did not have the opportunity to testify live. The email from the client is central to this case because 3 days after receiving the email, respondent sued his own client and claimed that he was being extorted for money by the client. The email states in part, "You do not have the right to take advantage of your clients, Bob. It is wrong and unethical. You knew I at one point in my life a couple of years ago was in an emotional state, and I am a single mother, and you took advantage of that. You thought you could get away with this, but you were wrong. I honestly hope that in the future you think about what you are doing before you do it. Treat people the way you want to be treated. Just because you are an attorney does not mean that you rule this world and you can do whatever you please." Unfortunately, the client's comments about lawyers are all too common. We are not a profession whose lawyers can do whatever they please and get away with it. At some point, all lawyers in this state are accountable to the Missouri Supreme Court and who issued the law license in the first place. For respondent, his time has come. Respondent Robert E. Arnold III needs to be removed from the practice of law to protect the integrity of the profession and to prevent other vulnerable members of the public from having their settlement money misappropriated and to prevent respondent from taking the property belonging to health care providers and other parties entitled to those trust funds. We'll then skip forward to 2 years after the passage I just read and read from a very short passage from an email or from a letter from the respondent to a disciplinary investigator. This is 2 years after the client submitted her email. The respondent says, "In looking back, I still believe my actions were both ethically and legally sound. These facts are undisputed. Respondent received a $25,000 settlement check on behalf of his client in June of 2012. He deposited the check into his IOLTA trust account that he had maintained for 7 years. The client never saw the check and never endorsed it. A month later, the entire settlement proceeds were gone as they were transferred to an operating account as part of a $275,000 transfer. There is not a single document in this voluminous record showing that the client consented to have respondent take the entire $25,000 settlement proceeds. The client repeatedly asked about the settlement money over the next 10 months. A work-in-progress draft of a settlement distribution sheet was submitted to the client in April of 2013. It was full of inaccuracies and material omissions and never showed how the settlement money was actually distributed. The client and her family spent the next 3 years in litigation to get the money back. Instead of admitting to the misappropriation of funds, respondent actually had the nerve to claim that he was being extorted by the client. He made those claims of extortion in a circuit court lawsuit, and he also even repeated the extortion excuse at the disciplinary hearing a year ago in April of 2017. Respondent has spent 4 years from May of 2013 to April of 2017 pretending to everyone involved that the settlement money remained in his trust account throughout the duration of the dispute. A Clay County, Missouri jury found respondent guilty of the tort of conversion and felt he should be financially punished for his conduct. A Clay County Circuit Court judge ordered respondent to pay back $15,000. The day of respondent's deposition in April 2017, he finally came clean. He admitted that the entire settlement amount was dispersed to himself by his operating account, and that none of the settlement money had been safeguarded in the trust account after the $275,000 transfer. At this advanced stage of this attorney disciplinary proceeding, OCDC is presenting to this court a case with overwhelming evidence of misappropriation of $16,000 in settlement proceeds.
Did he admit he had been falsely stating that it was in there, or did he claim he just figured out that it was gone at that point?
He self-reported to the Kansas Disciplinary Office that the money was not in his trust account. That then eventually was discovered in this case in the Missouri proceeding, and I believe from his deposition forward, he has admitted that the money was not in his trust account.
Does he admit he always knew that, or does he say that he thought it was there and only discovered at that time that it was not?
I believe his explanation was that from the time period of making the transfer in July of 2012 to the time of his deposition in April of 2017, he never checked his records, and so he never had reason to question whether the money was in the trust account or not. The DHP found that not to be very credible because there was intense litigation and scrutiny over these various settlement proceeds, and how can you not know where the settlement money is if you're engaged in litigation over it for that long period of time.
If I understand correctly, he claimed he was entitled to the money because it was payment for his work in the separate personal injury suit, is that right?
That's his claim, yes.
Was there ever any credit given to his client in that suit in the records for that money?
No, the respondent sent out monthly bills. The monthly bills showed an increasing balance due for the services rendered, so there was never any credit given. I think there was a credit given for $150 for overpayment of a filing fee or something, but there was never credit given that said, I took the $25,000 and applied it to your account, and here's the credit I'm showing you. Month after month, the client billing statements, the invoices, showed an increasing balance, never any decreasing or credits offered. So the misappropriation has now been established in a state circuit court and also by a disciplinary panel following 2 days of evidence. Although somewhat belatedly, it now appears that respondent admits the findings of misappropriation and dishonesty. He still seems to characterize the conduct as rooted in some form of an innocent dishonesty or innocent misappropriation. And he claims that he's ignorant of the most fundamental rules of safeguarding trust funds. Respondent has never demonstrated remorse towards the victim, and he has never apologized to the disciplinary investigators for creating this charade about where the settlement proceeds went to. From the beginning, OCDC has viewed this case as a situation warranting disbarment. With due respect to the disciplinary hearing panel, their recommendation of a stayed suspension is dangerously misguided in light of the documented findings of misappropriation and dishonesty. The panel did a very good job of making findings on the conduct involved. They found several instances of dishonesty. They found the correct instances of misappropriation. But they then took that conduct and believed that it merited a state suspension. So the most important issue before this court is the matter of whether there are compelling mitigating factors to justify a departure from the line of cases that really go from 2017 and In re McMillan all the way back to In re Stumbaugh, 123 Southwest 2nd 51, that was decided in 1938, all of which have held that disbarment is the appropriate sanction for misappropriation. Other than the absence of prior disciplinary history, the mitigators are just not there. In fact, the opposite is true, that there are many, many aggravating factors.
The DHP found mitigating.
They did. And there's one, of course, that's not disputed. The respondent has no prior disciplinary history in the state.
But you've argued contrary to their findings, because They found no clear evidence of dishonest or selfish motive, that he admitted wrongdoing and showed remorse. And you argue that those are incorrect findings.
That's correct. So I don't know how, on the one hand, you can find documented instances of dishonesty and lying and instances where the lawyer places his financial interests above his clients and his and other lien holders, and then say his motives weren't dishonest or selfish. I don't see how you can find where the respondent has lied to investigators and withheld information from investigators, and then also find as a mitigating factor that he cooperated in the investigation. They seem to be mutually exclusive, and that's why we are disputing them. This case, as I was reading In re Ferris last night, or actually I probably should say I reread it because I cited it in my brief, but there are many similarities from this case to In re Ferris, which is at 471 Southwest 3rd, 549, decided in 2015. In that case, the lawyer lied to cover up his misconduct. He provided OCDC with a check that he said represented his payment to healthcare providers. He never sent the check. In this case, we have a situation where the lawyer told us that he had kept back money in the trust account to pay the health care providers. He never did. In N. Ray Harris, the lawyer blamed all of the problems on a deceitful, conniving spouse. In this case, the respondent is trying to blame the his client who suffered from some mental health problems. In the Ferris case, the lawyer made a dogged refusal to make restitution. In this case, it took the respondent about 4 or 5 years, or 3 or 4 years, to make restitution. And so I would ask the court, in line of the cases of McMillan and Ferris and Ehler and all the way back to 1938, to impose the sanction of disbarment for the misappropriation and dishonesty. Thank you.
Mr. Chief Justice and honorable members of this court, good morning, and may it please the court. I'd like to just take a moment to say, actually selfishly, that it was 40 years ago this summer that I came down to this courthouse and with my mom and dad and took an oath that swore me in to become a member of this court, this bar, and this profession. And that was a substantial milestone in my life. I'm sure the same can be said for all of you. I hold dear and precious among the most important things in my life, the ability to carry on this profession. I consider it an honor and a privilege to do so. And virtually every colleague that I've come across in our profession has those same points of view. I've had the good fortune I don't want to call it the twilight of my career because I've got a few good years left, but I have been asked by lawyers to represent them in legal malpractice lawsuits. I've been asked to represent, such as Mr. Arnold, represent them in disciplinary matters. And I've made some observations along the way, and those include that none of us are perfect. I'm certainly not perfect, but mistakes are made. There are errors in judgment that are made, but I have rarely, if ever, come across a situation where by my own independent analysis, that I believe the lawyer who had committed an error in judgment or had made a mistake did so intentionally, but with an intent to either defraud their client or defraud someone else, some other member of the public. And frankly, if I felt that way, I wouldn't represent them, because while I'm here advocating on behalf of a client, I'm also advocating on behalf of the rule of law. And I try to live up to that oath that I took every day. And I do my best to strive to that level. And so when I come in here to tell you that I believe and I concur with the findings of the hearing panel that there was no evidence of a dishonest motive or a selfish motive in what happened here, it's hard for me to wrap my head around what all happened here because we've got a lawyer who has an impeccable record, both in New York, New Jersey, when he practiced back east, and then he moved to the Midwest. No disciplinary activity whatsoever. So did he just all of a sudden go off the rails with one client and decide he was going to become an unethical lawyer and disregard the rules that we hold so sacred? Or did he make errors in judgment that, frankly, many other people could have done? He was presented with a desperate client who badly needed and badly, desperately wanted representation to help change a child custody order. She didn't have the money to pay for a lawyer. Mr. Arnold devotes a substantial amount of his time to practice family law. He gives of his time freely. He often does not get paid. He volunteers his time to help people who have problems with child custody arrangements. He knew going in that the chances of getting paid what the entire charge for his work would never be received, and he expected that.
Counsel, can you address for me if this were a case as you're describing where she had orally agreed with him, as he says, that some of this money that was coming in the one case would be applied to representing her in the custody case, and she made statements about, I've got someone representing me now and so forth, and took that $8,000 or whatever part, $12,000 that was hers, and failed to get it in writing as he should have and so forth, that would be a much simpler case. But here, as I understand it, and I'm not quite sure I understand your answer to it, he didn't show in the custody case that money was applied towards her bill in that case, and he also took the money due the third-party providers from the trust account and didn't pay them and didn't show any record of that. And that's not explained by the fact that he was willing to give her a lot of the time for a little bit of money in the custody case, as you're describing. That doesn't justify taking money from the providers and not showing he's done that and not giving her credit for transferring that money over if it was done properly, but just not in writing as it should have been.
I will admit that what was done here is not a recommended practice, and truly this arrangement should have been documented.
So
it was not.
More specific,
yes.
How was it not shown if the point was to put it towards the other case, but the other case she never got a credit and you kept billing her as if there was no credit?
Well, the record shows that Mr. Arnold was sending they were called invoices, they were informational. He never asked her to pay those.
And the informational didn't have any information about applying the money you're saying was applied, though.
That is true, but he also
has to take a lot on faith, doesn't it?
Well, he had the record shows that Mr. Arnold testified that he had multiple conversations with the client throughout the time he was representing her, that she was aware of, approved of this arrangement, and understood how the money was going to be applied, which was a finding that was concurred in by not just the disciplinary hearing panel, but others who have investigated.
And what about the third-party provider's money?
That money should have remained in the trust account. Absolutely should have. And, and Mr. Arnold has admitted that and apologized for that.
I might be able to wrap my head around this, Mr. Larson, if this was disclosed when he filed a lawsuit, even. He says, look, it's not there. But he said it was still in his trust account at that point in time, according to what I've read. Is that accurate? How does he continue this? If this was an honest mistake, how does he continue that line of representations? At some point in time, it just looks really, really, really bad.
Well, two things. I first need to observe that the argument was made in your comment that he sued her. He he implemented an interpleader, which is, I think, the appropriate mechanism. I don't consider that suing
but
someone. I consider that
mechanism to put the money then in the court to let the court hold. And he represented that he had the money.
He represented that there was $25,000 that was in dispute, and I don't recall a specific representation where the money was situated, but. And I could be wrong about this, but I've always taken the point of view that on an interpleader, if I file as an attorney an interpleader for a client, I consider that money right then and there to be subject to the court's control.
Right.
And that's the way I viewed it when I came into this representation back then for Mr. Arnold when he received the counterclaim for the conversion, et cetera. And we did attempt to deposit money into the court registry without success.
You tried to and the court would not accept it?
Correct.
And where was that money coming from, the operating account or the trust account?
I believe that was a check drawn on the trust account that I had, and I went to the clerk's office and with along with Mr. Arnold and tried to deposit that, and they looked at us like they didn't know what we were talking about. But nevertheless, I was operating under the impression and belief that those funds were subject to the control of the court. Wherever they were physically located, they were subject to the control of the court.
What happened to the money then? I mean, so it went back into, they wouldn't take the check, so did you just rip the check up then? Or?
That check was torn up, is my understanding. That's what the testimony was. Yes, Judge.
But you're saying the money was there or was not there? Or anybody, ever checked their trust account records for 3 years?
I don't think there was a good understanding by Mr. Arnold of the his record keeping was not to where it should be. I think he's acknowledged that.
Is the explanation he offers that when he transferred the $275,000, I think it was, it should have been $250,000, that somehow there was a mistake and the $25,000 was taken out without realizing it?
No.
Or was it an argument that he was entitled to that money and he accidentally took the medical provider's money too?
He inappropriately transferred the money out of his trust account. But he intended to negotiate, like all of us do. Well, I don't do it because I don't do that personal injury work, but to negotiate the liens with the medical providers, but intended to do so out of his operating account.
And which is improper.
He should not have done that, and he has acknowledged that, yes.
So you're saying that was the mistake?
Yes. Yeah,
so
I do.
So the check he wrote to the deposit with the court in the interpleader action then came out of his trust account then?
It did, and I think the evidence testimony was that he had intended to, if that check, either he'd already put money in, back in out of his operating account, or was going to, and I don't recall exactly what was said in that regard, Your Honor.
So did he put $25,000 from the operating account into his trust account, or is he writing
no.
a bad check that for money that's not even there?
No, I don't think there was going to be a bad check situation. And I'm sorry, I don't know the specific answer to that. There was either money transferred to cover that check or there was going to be once it was deposited and accepted by the circuit court. And I don't know the answer. But continuing, the issue here, it's not a matter of if there were infractions because they've been acknowledged and we've accepted the findings and the report from the disciplinary hearing panel. I in particular recognize this court's function, and it's an appropriate one to review these issues carefully. And while you need not defer to the disciplinary hearing panel's findings, I think they are of significance because this was a two-day hearing with a very well-qualified panel. And
can you explain why its findings of no selfish motive are consistent with his taking the money out and not having that money in his trust account and so forth?
Well, I think that they considered it an inadvertent error, lack of intent, and lack of knowledge negligence, if you will, Your Honor, that he should not have removed that money that was at least arguably claimed against by those liens. And he did not know that that was a violation. He thought it was okay to do that. He's now clearly understood that that was the wrong thing to do and has acknowledged that.
Did he know he took the money out, or did he not know he took the money out when he later represented the money was still there in the account?
I think he did knowingly put the money at the disposal of his operating account for the purpose of negotiating those liens, yes. And then when I discovered that this prior statement to the disciplinary authorities in Kansas had been made, corrected that immediately, and you know, that matter stands for where it is. But
had he made that representation to disciplinary authorities in Missouri also?
I don't believe that he did one way or the other. At least I've not seen that specifically argued, but certainly acknowledge that there's an obligation and duty to give honest and truthful information, and it needs to be corrected if it's later determined that it was incorrect for whatever reason. So we're here now. Obviously, the only issue is what this honorable court decides is the appropriate discipline for these events. And the court's prior decisions are certainly of value and of interest to all of us, and we read them. All the cases seem to rise and fall on their own particular set of facts. But from what I saw a common thread in the disbarment cases involving trust accounts, and that's where either there was prior discipline or a dishonest and selfish motive or a combination of the two. The court has recognized that mitigating circumstances should be and must be looked at in cases of this nature. We have presented in our brief, and I'm almost out of time, but significant evidence of mitigation, which the disciplinary hearing panel recognized and observed. He's well standing in his community. He's well thought of. He works hard for his clients. This is all unrefuted by the informant, that we just strongly believe, and I strongly believe, that there is a discipline that is lesser than disbarment, as recognized by the DHP, that is appropriate in these circumstances. This man is salvageable. He's done this job. He's done this for a long time. I'm not going to call it a job. It's our profession. We practice it. He's recognized his errors. He's implementing plans to prevent any repeat occurrence with the trust accounts. He would willingly and happily submit to whatever supervisory terms of probation this court would deem fit. But I do ask you to let him continue to practice his profession. And with that, I'll close unless there's any further questions.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors.
I'll try to clear up a few things. The issue of the attempt to deposit funds with the Registry of the Court in Clay County is set forth on pages 33 and 34 of the informant's brief. The funds were not even attempted to be deposited until at least 2 or 3 months after the lawsuit was filed. There was testimony that a check was taken to the court on the day that that happened. If you look at the trust account balances, the balances were not sufficient to cover a $15,000 check. The balances in the trust account were like $1,000, $2,000, $3,000. The trust account check would have bounced if it was actually accepted by the court in Clay County. Respondent's testimony was that he knew that his trust account balance wouldn't cover it. But if the court accepted the payment, then he would have made some sort of immediate electronic transfer of funds from his operating account to his trust account. I'd also like to clear up the issue about the difference in the representations made to the Kansas investigators and the representations made to the Missouri investigator, which in this case was me. He told the Kansas administrator, or disciplinary office, that all of the settlement proceeds remained in the trust account for the duration of the dispute. He told the Missouri investigators that all but $5,000 had been dispersed, but he was holding back that $5,000 to pay the claims of healthcare providers once the liens had been negotiated down. There's about $11,000 in liens, and he, I guess, unilaterally determined that he was going to be able to reduce those to about $5,000, and he claimed that he held back $5,000. We then realized that that was not true. I'd also like to point out that we do have a system of progressive discipline, but there are cases where, without regard to prior disciplinary offense, if you commit misappropriation and other acts of dishonesty, that's the most serious type of misconduct that we have, and it justifies disbarment. Last year, in Ray McMillan, was also a trust account misappropriation case. Mr. McMillan had no prior discipline. He was disbarred.
Do we have any explanation of why all this occurred in this case, but there's no indication of any similar misconduct in other cases?
No explanation. It's been troubling to me because this $25,000 was transferred from the trust account along with $250,000 of other trust funds. I've never been able to figure out what happened to that money. No other clients or third parties have come forward to complain about that. But if you look at his trust account history and statements, that $275,000 transaction is very, very unusual, and there's no explanation for it. But no, we have no other information about any other instances of misappropriation or mismanagement of the trust account, other than we do know that in order to pay the client or the client's heirs and the healthcare providers, that he took personal money and then deposited into the trust account so he could show everyone that he paid everyone off with trust account checks, which obviously is a separate act of trust account misconduct, but it doesn't necessarily involve misappropriation.
Counselor, you're out of time.
Thank you.